So good morning, everybody. This is Jonathan Perk from Downstate Neurology, and with me today I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Jose Cabasa, who is a movement disorder specialist in our department. Good morning, Jose.
Good morning.
So
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much for being here. Today we're going to talk about treatment approaches to Parkinson's disease. So what are actually the targets of and the goals of treatment of Parkinson's disease?
Well, just to start off with, I mean, the first thing to consider when you're approaching a Parkinson's patient, especially now I should be talking about just early treatment of Parkinson's, is certainly to recognize whether there's the presence of both motor and non-motor symptoms as you certainly, as you plan how to treat, both of these categories will come into play in terms of your choice of, you know, how to start the treatment. In Parkinson's, Parkinson's disease itself is very varied between patient to patient. So the treatment is actually very individualized. It has to do with things like the patient's age, their symptoms, how severe they are, certainly occupational status and lifestyle, and then the other comorbidities, whether they're medical comorbidities you expect in an older person, or comorbidities related to the non-motor symptoms. So things like cognition, issues with cognition, behavior, and their psychiatric status. However, even though it's very individualized and there's certainly an art to this, a lot of these treatments have been validated through double-blind randomized control studies, very famous or relatively well-known ones, like things like L-DOPA study, looking at levodopa, BetaTop, which looked at selegiline, and the Tempo and Adagio, which more recently looked at risagiline.
So how about let's dive into treatments of the motor symptoms.
Sure. So the gold standard, if we can call it such, or the main treatment of Parkinson's is certainly levodopa, which in combination with carbidopa gets converted in the brain to dopamine, the main deficit in Parkinson's. So carbidopa, levodopa still remains the most effective treatment for all stages of Parkinson's. Even though we are well aware of the long-term complications, things like wearing on and off phenomena and levodopa-induced dyskinesias, we certainly know or how to at least delay the onset of these fluctuations better nowadays, and we certainly know how to just really new paradigm seems to be just to keep the levodopa levels low, but adding other medications that I will be talking about shortly. But certainly there's been a lot of, the question always is, when do you start levodopa? There's always been two camps or two strategies, in jest I call them levodopa versus levodopa phobia, meaning some people do want to delay the starting levodopa versus people wanting to start it right away. As an initial treatment to Parkinson's, we know that we tend to choose older individuals who are susceptible to side effects, so we tend to want to start levodopa first. And also depends on when do you need maximum control of symptoms. So it certainly depends on the profession and the lifestyle. If somebody, you know, the classic example of it, if it's a surgeon developing a resting tremor, you might want to treat levodopa right away. That way they can at least for a time being continue practicing. Now the other camp is do we delay levodopa fearing some of these long-term side effects, and that's where we would instead choose other drugs that I'll talk about shortly, like MAO-B inhibitors or dopamine agonists. And often the strategy is thought of is, especially if the patient is a young patient, that certainly will have a long period of exposure to dopaminergics. So we'll much more predictably develop these motor fluctuations or problems down the road. One little thing to add with levodopa that I've recently found interesting and also problematic is that once you start a patient on levodopa, especially once they get to a certain high dose, you have to be very careful to discontinue it, as there's been certainly descriptions about people developing a neuromalignant syndrome like problem.
By the way, here I suggest that we actually have a separate podcast talking about movement disorder emergency, okay. And we actually discuss that.
Very good. So I'll move on. All right. So, and just to finish off with the carbidopa levodopa, the main formulations are 25 over 100 and 25 over 250. And these are the immediate release formulations. There's also a control release formulation, but now there's a newer formulation that seems to be better than the control release. Its name is Rytary. It's still carbidopa levodopa, but now this new formulation has both an immediate and an extended release medication, and it does seem that that in the future this is going to be used much more widely. It's giving it does allow for better control with less of these motor fluctuations or side effects like dyskinesias that I talked about. So moving along to just briefly to cover some of the other medications, we have COMT inhibitors. And the main one being entacapone. Typically these medications add about 30 minutes of extra on time when you add it to levodopa in combination. This seemed to be promising in the when it first came out in combination with carbidopa levodopa in the form of Stalevo. We thought that people would have less of these long-term side effects, but unfortunately it seem to create more dyskinesias. So right now it's a medication that we can always use, but truly the adding 30 minutes, you know, you always have to make sure if that's enough, because often it's not. So it does have a relatively limited role nowadays. Moving along to other dopaminergics, are the famous or infamous dopamine agonists, and these include pramipexole, ropinirole, and rotigotine, which now comes in the form of a patch. The efficacy for early treatment is very well established. However, the side effects are really what limits the use of these medications. Certainly, they've associated with more hallucinations than levodopa, for example. But very problematic side effects also include daytime sleepiness, which can occur sudden attacks. So somebody just very quickly nods off without recognizing that they're even sleepy, and it has led to a lot of motor vehicle accidents. Then the other major side effect that's very popular in the press is recognizing that they can cause impulse control disorders, which tend to be along the lines of the person's own impulsivities, where they pathologically are more impulsive, so they can, for example, gamble away their life savings. They can have compulsive eating or buying or inappropriate sexual behavior. So recognizing this, and knowing that it's efficacy is there, but it's still not as good as levodopa. We know that, you know, we're a lot more cautious using those medications. And head to head, when we actually look at levodopa versus dopamine agonists, the quality of life, even in people who started with levodopa is better than dopamine agonists. So that's certainly something to consider. And the bottom line and the reality of how I'm using all these medications, just to kind of overly summarize this, is use most of these medications where you just keep the doses low, so you are able to avoid a lot of these side effects. Just to finish off two more treatment categories, and by the way, these are all for motor symptoms. So for motor symptoms of Parkinson's, I'm talking about resting tremor, rigidity, bradykinesia and then the gait disorder that comes along with it. So moving along, we also have MAO-B inhibitors. These include selegiline and rasagiline. They have a modest symptomatic motor benefit. However, there's a thought that they might additionally be neuroprotective. And this was, especially for rasagiline, there's a very unique trial called the late start study design, where in this paradigm, we were trying to prove whether the medication did not only help motor symptoms, but it also modified the disease. Hence, it was neuroprotective. But unfortunately, the results did not have sufficient evidence to support or refute it at this point. We still use them, especially with very mild early symptoms. You often can choose an MAO-B inhibitor to start off with before you start dopamine agonist or levodopa. Last but certainly not least, in terms of medications for motor symptoms, is amantadine. Amantadine is a very unique medication, and it does have an NMDA glutamate antagonist activity, but it also has other and at times unclear mechanisms of action. Now, amantadine seems to help mildly some of the motor symptoms in Parkinson's, and certainly does appear to be better for tremor versus Parkinsonism itself, but it's also the only oral medication approved for drug levodopa-induced dyskinesias. Certainly, and for advanced treatment, something like deep brain stimulation is also very good for dyskinesias, but early on, amantadine is the drug of choice, but is very well tolerated, and we certainly use it often. One of the other components to treating motor symptoms in Parkinson's and has become very clear nowadays, and that is exercise. Adding not only oral medications, but some sort of exercise plan where the patient either is exercising on their own, they're doing it through physical therapy or through support groups. But the benefit has been widely accepted, and in combination with levodopa, it might be additionally beneficial for the patient to just improve their overall motor function. So hinting at some neuroplasticity as a mechanism here. Just to finish off, there's some investigational treatments that are still being tried, that are still developed. And interestingly enough, just like the new formulation of levodopa, a lot of these new treatments are modeling after medications that already are known to work. So they're looking at medications that are similar to amantadine, for example. And interestingly enough, they're also looking at the medications that have that work like caffeine do as well, because we do think that caffeine might be beneficial for Parkinson's as well, at least in a limited role.
Wow, that was a fantastic overview on the motor aspects of Parkinson's. And I think it's only been in recent years that there was more increased focus on the non-motor symptoms, I guess, autonomic dysfunction, the depression, and the effects on cognition, which years ago was not actually thought to be as part of inherently a subcortical pathology. So how do we attack those symptoms?
Right. So non-motor symptoms certainly have had a lot of interest, and for good reason. They certainly seem to affect at times quality of life much more than even the motor symptoms themselves, and that's not too far-fetched to think about this. But so certainly, identifying these non-motor symptoms can be helpful even to treat the motor symptoms. So what are these non-motor symptoms? Some of these symptoms, might be actually the earliest symptoms of Parkinson's. So it might be, they might start occurring the premotor phase. So part of the interest in looking at this is that they might be potentially biomarkers for the motor disease. So One of the main non-motor categories include autonomic dysfunction, which is can be relatively varied, but certainly can involve neurogenic orthostatic hypotension. And very interestingly enough, we do use either conservative therapy when patients have orthostatic hypotension, like increasing fluid and salt load if they can. We use things like midodrine and fluticortisone for more advanced cases, but now we actually have a new medication, not relatively new, at least newly approved, to treat neurogenic orthostatic hypotension in Parkinson's, which is droxidopa. And very interesting enough, the medication itself, which has recently been approved, this seems to be very effective, but in essence, the mechanism of action is that it gets converted to norepinephrine. So yet now we're replacing potentially a second neurotransmitter here, and also hinting at that Parkinson's disease is involves multiple neurotransmitters, and certainly the non-motor issues highlight that, as we'll see. Another very common non-motor symptom in the category of autonomics is constipation, which certainly can predate Parkinson's, and certainly is a very common problem in the general population. So not everybody that has constipation will develop Parkinson's. But what constipation does, though, is it highlights the importance of absorption when you're administering drugs. Because we know now that constipation might actually impact levodopa absorption. So treating constipation potentially will not only relieve the discomfort of and the problems with constipation, but potentially can even improve motor function as well. Other just quick autonomic issues people can have the sialorrhea, which we can actually effectively treat with botulinum toxin. People can develop sexual dysfunction and urinary problems, meaning urinary frequency, and some of the newer anticholinergics, which we think might make Parkinson's worse, are actually okay. They do not seem to make the motor symptoms worse, so they are widely used now. Other non-motor categories moving along include things like affective disorders, so things like depression and anxiety. And we do treat them like we would treat any person with depression or anxiety, except that sometimes, it's especially for depression, there's been a trend to use SNRIs as well as SSRIs, again partially highlighting that this potentially is a multi-neurotransmitter disease. Now the last category in this mood disorders is actually apathy. And that's one thing that we fail in being able to treat effectively, as any movement disorder or even any psychiatrist can tell you. But this tends to be one of the more challenging mood problems that somebody in Parkinson's can face. Moving along, this kind of falls sometimes between mood and cognition, and psychosis in Parkinson's include delusions, and hallucinations. They can be a feature of the disease or the treatment. So initially, one of the treatment strategies once people develop hallucinations is to reduce the dopaminergics, but often that will compromise their motor disease. So you have to then think, would they benefit from an additional agent? There's been some conventional knowledge, at least how I was taught, but now there are at least some double-blind randomized trials using cholinesterase inhibitors to treat early or mild hallucinations or psychosis. And in my experience, I do find that, in a way, I try to kill two birds with one stone with at least improving a little bit their cognition or their attention with something like Benepicil, and potentially blocking or improving their psychosis, especially if you have to make the decision of actually increasing the dopaminergics if their motor symptoms are undertreated. Now, the other medications we use, which fall in the category of dopamine blockers, might seem counterintuitive to use, but For the most part, we don't use most neuroleptics to treat psychosis of Parkinson's. However, both quetiapine and clozapine, potentially through a D5 receptor mechanism, tend to be effective for psychosis and Parkinson's without worsening their motor symptoms. Talking more about the cognition, and I would add in the kind of an attentional component or an executive dysfunction. These are the major areas, major domains of cognition affected in Parkinson's versus, for example, Alzheimer's, which tends to be more amnestic, especially early on, tends to affect more memory itself. But however, we still use the same medication. So we use donepezil, we use rivastigmine, which comes in a patch, and we also use memantine or Namenda, in combination. And like anything else, we often just see a mild to modest benefit. Going through other quick non-motor symptoms, sleep, just very quickly, there are various problems with sleep in Parkinson's, but very importantly is the recognition of REM sleep behavior disorder, because it's potentially one of the earliest biomarkers of Parkinson's, and it could, even though it could lead to very amusing stories, it could also lead to very significant injury in the patient, and it's very easily treated with a low dose benzo at bedtime. REM sleep behavior disorder, the patients are acting out their dreams during REM sleep, and they can become quite violent, injuring their bed partner or injuring themselves. So moving along, other non-motor symptoms that I'm not going to go into are include pain and fatigue, and again, just recognizing that these symptoms exist, you could potentially, is how you can be a better doctor to your patient by really providing comprehensive treatment. All of this is that I've talked about is really early treatment of Parkinson's. In later stages of Parkinson's, and that might be another talk, is where we talk about things like deep brain stimulation, which is very effective and is widely used now.
So that's a fantastic overview. So why don't you maybe summarize some key points and sure. take home messages for our listeners?
Sure. So levodopa or combination carbidopa levodopa is still number one. It's still the drug of choice. It's still seemingly the most effective, including choosing it as early treatment. Even though the strategy should always be, if you're starting early, is to keep the levels low, potentially maybe less than 400 milligrams per day. But overall, it still gives better long-term quality of life and less side effects when you compare them to dopamine agonists. And then these newer formulations that I mentioned is really trying to mimic a normal physiologic state, which I think has always been the intent in treating Parkinson's. Other Parkinson's medications can be very beneficial, even though they might have a limited role due to side effects. Just very particularly amantadine is what we use for dyskinesias, but is also good for treatment of motor symptoms as well. And also to remember that exercise should be part of the treatment strategy. As in combination, these patients seem to do the best. Lastly is to also always try to consider and treat non-motor symptoms in Parkinson's, including dysautonomia, sleep, pain, and pain problems, mood disorders, and cognition, as these often have the biggest impact on quality of life, not only for the patient, but for their caregiver. So I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah,
thank you.
Fantastic. That certainly helped me organize my thoughts on the treatment approaches of Parkinson's. So thank you very much, Jose Cabasa, our movement disorder specialist here at City Downstate Neurology Department. And this is Jonathan Kirk. And until next time, thank you very much. Bye-bye.